Boost. While I'm sure Tarantino loves to hear talk show hosts plead for more, he has better reasons for early retirement. "I like the idea of being defined by a filmography," he told Rybov, "that was all artistic and by intention, as opposed to just working because I don't know how to stop." "I think a lot of directors," he explained to Kimmel, "they talk about, oh, I want to do this thing and that thing. I have time to do this and time to do that. But I actually think they have far less time than they think they do. If I think I only have two movies, well, that keeps it at the tip of the spear, if you know what I mean. That means those ones better be good." "I like the idea," he soothed Travers, "that there is an umbilical cord connected to my first film all the way to my last. And then that is the body of work, because I am about my filmography. And frankly, I do feel bad films on the filmography affect good films on the filmography." Quentin Tarantino thinks in oeuvres, the fancy and hard-to-pronounce French word for body of work. That, in itself, doesn't make him unique. Most artists consider the arc of their life's work, especially when that life nears its end. They might look back and discover some big themes in their career. They might try to divide it into chapters or phases, or even agree to a retrospective. It's natural to think about legacy, and the most lasting legacies usually come from oeuvres, not single works. Shakespeare, Picasso, The Beatles, Beyoncé, Dickens, Hitchcock, Morrison, Miyazaki. Tarantino would love to join this list, as many other artists would. Like many other artists, he'll submit his oeuvre to posterity for consideration. What makes Tarantino unusual is that while most artists look back at their body of work, he's been carefully shaping his own from the start. For him, the filmography itself is a work of art. Just as great movies shouldn't have weak scenes, great filmographies shouldn't have weak movies. Like bad performances can spoil a good script, lesser projects can spoil a legacy. That's what Tarantino believes. He's eager to avoid the major-minor game that film nerds like me play with revered filmmakers. Shutter Island is minor Scorsese, we might say, compared to major works like Raging Bull and Taxi Driver. Girl Six is minor Spike Lee, next to Malcolm X and Do the Right Thing. These minor movies often appear toward the end of a career. Alfred Hitchcock's final five films barely register against his many masterpieces. Lopping them off the filmography wouldn't diminish his reputation. In fact, Tarantino might argue that Hitchcock's legacy would be even greater today if he'd walked away from cinema in 1963 and not 1976. Artists don't always notice when their skills are flagging, so Tarantino is quitting early to prevent crossing that line unwittingly. 10 movies are enough for a good, healthy filmography. It's 3 less than Kubrick, but 3 more than Tarkovsky. And the 9 he's made so far are all pretty good. He began with The Electric Reservoir Dogs, followed it up with Pulp Fiction, an era-defining masterpiece, and his most recent movie, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, ranks among his best. Not every release in between reaches these peaks. Death Proof and The Hateful Eight are my least favorite. But I don't think Tarantino's made any real clunkers. That's my opinion, of course. You're welcome to disagree, something film nerds love to do. You might not be a fan of Tarantino's style or my opinion of it, but for the purposes of this essay, you don't have to be. I'm less interested in the quality of his movies than in his perspective on oeuvre, what he or any artist might gain by thinking of their career holistically. It's clear Tarantino sees a reputational value in having a body of work that maintains a high standard, that's free of dead weight. But is there a value to the work itself? Can a well-designed oeuvre bestow greater meaning onto the projects that make it up, can a body of work be a work of art? Chapter 2, Heart to Heart. To answer these questions, I searched for other artists who shared Quentin Tarantino's obsession with oeuvre. I found William Butler Yeats, an Irish poet working in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Yeats wrote some of the most powerful verse of his or any time. As a symbolist, he believed reality could be described only indirectly with the aid of metaphor and illusion. So he mined the images of myth, mysticism, and magic and channeled their symbolic power to cast light on human nature. He was a master of rhythm and form. To read him is to be entranced. Unlike Hitchcock, he improved to the very end. Like Tarantino, he embraced a macro perspective on his art. His project always was to give his work organic unity, writes John Unterrecker in A Reader's Guide to William Butler Yeats. Everything, he felt, should fit into a whole. Yeats reworked many of his poems and plays, rearranging the sequence of the poems so that they would construct harmonious units, dropping any of those that did not fit into the grand scheme. Yeats went further than Tarantino has. He revised and even removed previous work to strengthen his oeuvre. Yeats viewed his body of work as a living thing, always open to change if he found a better image or turn of phrase, or if his thinking changed and suddenly his new poetry fell out of sync with his old. That was permission enough to modify a stanza or two for better consistency. One day when I was 23 or 24, he recalled in 1919, this sentence seemed to form in my head without my willing it, much as sentences form when we are half asleep. Hammer your thoughts into unity. Did he achieve that unity? If so, how? And if so, what did he accomplish by doing it? Absolute unity is probably an impossible ambition, Unterrecker argues, but Yeats came as close as any artist to realizing it, and he did this by organizing his work around recurring people, images, and systems. Take a look at his most famous poem, for example, The Second Coming. Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart, the center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Surely some revelation is at hand. Surely the second coming is at hand. The second coming. Hardly are those words out when a vast image out of Spiritus Mundi troubles my sight. Somewhere in the sands of the desert, a shape with lion body and the head of a man, a gaze blank and pitiless as the sun, is moving its slow thighs, while all about it reel shadows of the indignant desert birds. The darkness drops again. But now I know that 20 centuries of stony sleep were vexed to nightmare by a rocking cradle. And what rough beast, its hour come round at last, slouches toward Bethlehem to be born. You don't have to know Yeats's ideology to get something from this poem. The Second Coming describes a nightmarish vision at the end of an era when the norms that organized it come undone and bad actors rule in the blood-dimmed tide of anarchy that ensues. A new age dawns, but The Second Coming has a sinister feel, a gaze blank and pitiless as the sun. This revelation takes the form of a rough beast. It may deliver us from the present dysfunction, but into what? The story itself is remarkably potent. It has the uncanny quality nightmares have of being general yet personal, and the more you think about it, the more the story seems to find real-world analogs. Could the rough beast, a terror that inaugurates a new world, could it be war? A revolution? What about a global pandemic? Can't you see the worst full of passionate intensity in the lead-up to the Great Recession, the housing bubble slouching toward Wall Street to burst? The prophecy of the poem can fit a range of historical events, even ones that haven't yet reached their climax, like climate change. Yeats wrote the poem in the wake of World War I, a conflict that saw death and destruction on an unprecedented scale. 4 years of that, plus the Russian Revolution, a flu pandemic, and the start of the Irish War of Independence, left Europe in a cynical mood. Yeats felt it. Maybe the center wouldn't hold. Maybe things would fall apart. Maybe they already had. It wasn't absurd to see that moment as a kind of apocalypse. The poem reflects that view. And as much as every generation thinks its crisis is the hinge point of history, the Second Coming will continue to find resonances. But there's something more systematic at work here. Around this time, Yeats created a philosophy of history that reflected his many interests, and the Second Coming is also an expression of that. The system is far too elaborate to explain in detail, but the basic idea is this. History develops in 2,000-year cycles, represented by Yeats as interpenetrating cones called gyres. Every new era is born from the ashes of the old. It grows, reaches its peak, wanes, and eventually collapses into the next era, which will have opposite values to the one preceding it. Yeats believed that the birth of Christ was the start of the current cycle, and his system predicts that the Christian era will end by AD 2100. The title of The Second Coming recalls the biblical idea of revelation, but the era to come will bear little resemblance to the Christian era, and as the poem makes clear, its Messiah will be radically different from Jesus Christ. Once you know Yeats's ideology, it's impossible to see The Second Coming as a standalone piece. Like all his poems, it's a thread in a larger tapestry, and the questions it poses have responses elsewhere in the oeuvre. In Two Songs from a Play, for example, published almost a decade after The Second Coming, Yeats looks at the implications of his theory by turning back the clock 2,000 years to the ending of the previous historical cycle. I saw a staring virgin stand where holy Dionysus died, and tear the heart out of his side, and lay the heart upon her hand, and bear that beating heart away. And then did all the muses sing of Magnus Annus at the spring, as though God's death were but a play. The first stanza mixes figures from two religious traditions. The staring virgin is the Virgin Mary, and holy Dionysus is a Greek god of wine, fertility, and festivity. In the Greek myth, Athena retrieves Dionysus's heart after he's dismembered by the Titans and gives it to Zeus, who resurrects him. In Yeats's version, Mary takes the heart instead to bear a new god and a new epoch. The classical age gives way to the Christian age, just as the Christian age gives way to the rough beast in the Second Coming. Yeats goes on. Another Troy must rise and set, another lineage feed the crow, another Argo's painted prow drive to a flashier bauble yet. The Roman Empire stood appalled. It dropped the reins of peace and war when that fierce virgin and her star out of the fabulous darkness called. Things repeat in cycles, Yeats says. The gyre will widen again. Troy will again let that huge wooden horse inside its walls. What's disturbing is the weary tone, another, 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 repetitive like the historical cycles, but repetition without progress or a sense of renewal. Then he switches perspectives to people on the ground. The coming of Jesus shocks and horrifies the Roman world, which has ruled for so long. Mary and her star arrive from the fabulous darkness and change everything. Is this how we might react to the arrival of the rough beast? Is this how historical change is always experienced? To an old guard, change can seem to materialize out of darkness, enigmatic and appalling. In pity for man's darkening thought, he walked that room and issued thence, in Galilean turbulence, the Babylonian starlight brought a fabulous, formless darkness in. Odor of blood when Christ was slain made all Platonic tolerance vain and vain all Doric discipline. Not only does Christ arrive out of darkness, as we saw in the previous stanza, but he brings a fabulous, formless darkness with him. He is that darkness. Yeats paraphrases the Neoplatonist philosopher Antoninus, who watched the rising tide of Christianity in the 4th century and worried that a fabulous and formless darkness is about to tyrannize over all that is beautiful on earth. Beautiful things like the Platonic tolerance of multicultural polytheistic Rome. Does something equally brilliant replace these beauties? No, it's something repulsive, the overwhelming odor of Christ's blood. Everything that man esteems endures a moment or a day. Love's pleasure drives his love away. The painter's brush consumes his dreams. The herald's cry, the soldier's tread, exhaust his glory and his might. Whatever flames upon the night, man's own resinous heart has fed. In the astonishing final stanza of Two Songs from a Play, the grand cycles of history disappear. Yeats's convoluted system of gyres yields to a lucid observation about life. All things must pass. Life follows the same pattern as history, as Jesus and Dionysus, birth, death, and resurrection. But resurrection, as Yeats makes clear in the earlier stanzas, doesn't guarantee progress. What's guaranteed is that rebirths will be rocky, marked by darkness and ruin. Or at least that's how they'll feel to those who live through them. Transience and turbulence are the only sure things. All we can do is endure, captive to the tides and the rough beasts of our time. History slouches over us all while the muses sing. Depressing, right? Yeats had a morbid fascination with decay and death. When I was a boy, everybody talked about progress, he once wrote. And rebellion against my elders took the form of aversion to that myth. I felt a sort of ecstasy at the contemplation of ruin. There was plenty of ruin to contemplate in his lifetime, much of it senseless. It was hard not to feel caught in the currents of history, easy to feel powerless. To recapture some agency, Yeats fit current events into a grand system. But that only raised the issue of agency again. If you could really find the pattern of history, what space does that leave for human beings to influence it? He confronts this question in the final two lines of the poem, which arrive like a sudden reversal. Whatever flames upon the night, man's own resinous heart has fed. It's true that the currents of history govern human thought, that we dream what our time permits us to dream. But it's also true that those currents are created by human thought. It's a feedback loop. History makes us, and we make history. The bulk of the poem emphasizes the tragedy of the former, but the ending offers a counterpoint in this dazzling circular image. Man's resinous heart feeding all that flames upon the night, ultimately consumed by that same fire. For this reason, critic David A. Ross argues, the poem ends with a flourish of defiant humanism, with an appeal to creativity in the face of ruin and giant historical forces. The ending does not negate the poem's weary, pessimistic tone, but it does qualify it. This is what all Yeats's poems do. They expand, deepen, and qualify the other poems in the oeuvre. Two Songs from a Play adds definition to the nightmare vision of the Second Coming. It helps us to understand Yeats's anxieties about the transformations in his world, It places the rough beast in a line with Jesus and Dionysus, explores the cyclical nature of human affairs, shows us that perspectives can change dramatically in the fullness of time. It tempers the fatalism of the Second Coming with a note of defiance, even hope. In the first poem, we are defenseless against that vast image out of Spiritus Mundi. In the last lines of Two Songs from a Play, Yeats restores some power to the creative, if flammable, human heart. And it doesn't end there. You can track these themes up and down his body of work. You can take any image out of either of those poems, blood, gyre, birds, fire, and trace their usages across the oeuvre. Every usage modifies every other, layering meaning on meaning until images evolve into symbols that support immense complexity. This is all intentional. No word in a Yeats poem was ever chosen carelessly, no line ever constructed without consideration of the greater architecture. Take the word heart, for example. As we've just seen, Yeats places the heart at the center of a great historical process. Its desires are the engine of cultural change and also the fuel. And yet, despite its major role in the drama of history, the human heart is resinous, like the gooey, flammable stuff that oozes from tree trunks. The heart is our link to the perishable world, an image of mortality. For Yeats, this makes it the perfect symbol to contrast with the eternal realm of beauty and art, which preoccupied his mind in later life. In Sailing to Byzantium, published in the same book as Two Songs from a Play, he implores the sages of the holy city of Byzantium to consume my heart away, sick with desire and fastened to a dying animal, it knows not what it is, and gather me into the artifice of eternity. Another image of a heart devoured. Yeats longs to escape the prison of the body, which decays in old age like a dying animal. He longs to escape his heart, sick with desires that make it combustible, and fuse with eternity. Here, heart aligns with sick and dying animals and opposes what is immortal and outside of nature. But Yeats longs in vain. As he complains in the next poem called The Tower, he is trapped within his body. What shall I do with this absurdity? O heart, O troubled heart, this caricature, decrepit age that has been tied to me as to a dog's tail. Unable to escape from his decaying heart, Yeats looks elsewhere for consolation. In Meditations in Time of Civil War, he reflects on a gift he received from Junzo Sato, a 500-year-old ancestral sword. Taken by its beauty, he memorializes the antique weapon in verse. Chaucer had not drawn breath when it was forged. In Sato's house, curved like new moon, moon luminous, it lay 500 years. Yet if no change appears, no moon, only an aching heart conceives a changeless work of art. Looking on Sato's sword, Yeats comes to a realization. Though he can't escape his body and join with eternity, he can create something that will, a changeless work of art. What's more, it's only a human heart, an aching heart, sick with desire, that could produce such a timeless creation. Maybe there's some solace in that thought. Or maybe that's too simple. After all, Sato's sword isn't really changeless, is it? It survived for half a millennium, but it won't last forever. A student of the destructive nature of history, Yeats can't blind himself to the basic impermanence of things, even the best works of art. So, what solace is there? Is there any comfort against age, death, the fading away of our work? Yeats takes up the question in Vacillation. He offers some potential answers, but predictably vacillates. Eventually, he recognizes that impermanence itself might be the only truth that matters. From man's blood-sodden heart are sprung those branches of night and day, where the gaudy moon is hung. What's the meaning of all song? Let all things pass away. 5 years later, Yeats returns to the concluding lesson of Two Songs from a Play, again choosing the heart as his symbol. The subject is the same, but the imagery is different. The resinous heart is now blood-sodden and planted in fertile ground to grow a tree. As in Meditations in Time of Civil War, the heart is the source of our creations, but such creations are not changeless or out of nature. Like us, they are transitory, vacillating, emphatically in nature. Coming to terms with that doesn't have to be depressing. In Vacillation, Yeats finds tranquility in the thought, even joy. He understands that transience is the highest theme for the artist, while eternity is only a mirage. Empowered by that awareness, Yeats rode this tragic joy to the end of his life. In 1939, the year of his death at 73, his final volume was published, called Last Poems. In The Circus Animal's Desertion, Yeats trawls back through his poetry and revisits the characters and images he worked with for so long. He dwells on themes of the embittered heart and heart mysteries. He wonders if he loved his poetic myths too much instead of those things that they were emblems of. At the end of his career and life, he finally reflects on where those images came from. In very nearly his final lines, he adds one last meaning to a fruitful symbol. Now that my ladder's gone, I must lie down where all the ladders start, in the foul rag and bone shop of the heart. In the 19th century, rag and bone men scavenged unwanted household items and sold them to merchants. That's what Yeats envisions as the poet's job, to scavenge items from the heart and sell them to the public, to weave all that detritus into images and stories and truth. The heart is the well into which any artist must descend for raw materials. It is the seed of the tree of man's transience. It's the locus of great historical cycles, what Mary tears from Dionysus's side to birth the Christian age. It's the troubled heart, the trembling heart, the burning, wild, importunate heart. It's the heart that could bear no more, that drifts through the violet air, the heart that laughter made sweet, that troubles your peace. I cast my heart into my rhymes, he tells us. And we see that he did, again and again and again. By the time of his death, heart vibrates with meanings. It becomes a spring-loaded word, ready to explode across any line or verse, expanding, deepening. Yeats built his symbols meticulously, line by line, until he created an arsenal versatile enough for any subject. And if you're familiar with his poetry and come across one of his favorite symbols, you can't help but recall the other poems in which it was used, how it was used, and what you felt about it. His oeuvre resembles one of those detective pinboards you see on TV, where the case is arrayed over a large surface. News clippings, photographs, evidence, all of it linked by crisscrossing red twine. Touch one piece, set the twine quivering, and your eyes start dashing back and forth. It's silly to think of Yeats's poems as individual units when each one contains insights from every other. Can a body of work be a work of art? Yes, Yeats proves that beyond a doubt, I think. While each poem has a completeness of its own, the overall unity is his ultimate expression. Its wisdom is dense and complex. The answers it offers are not easy or even consistent. They're often contradictory, but that's not a weakness of the oeuvre. Yeats never aimed for a logician's unity. His body of work doesn't resemble a proof so much as it does a human personality, which we know is full of ambiguity and contradiction. Yeats's work vacillates like a person does, like he did. It probes stubborn questions about existence from every angle. It draws on the oeuvres of other great thinkers, tests its insights against the insights of genius. It's confident and timid, exuberant and grave, epic and intimate. It gives off sparks even now. Even now, it lives. Chapter 3. The Goods. What about Tarantino? Snobs might balk at comparing the Nobel laureate Yates with a filmmaker who once staged a fight in which 50-plus people are killed/dismembered by a samurai sword-wielding woman in a yellow jumpsuit. But what do they know? The more I researched Yates and Tarantino, the more they seem to me kindred artists. I'm not sure either of them would agree with that, Yates in particular, though I like to imagine he would have had fun at Kill Bill. A few similarities jump out. They're both perfectionists. They're both expert craftsmen with deep and broad, and in the case of Tarantino, encyclopedic knowledge of their media. Their works overflow with references to past masters. They are both respected among peers. Both dwell on legacy. Both think in oeuvres. Most of all, they're both obsessive. Yates was obsessed with mysticism and the occult. He pored over dense and obscure texts, extracting whatever patterns he found there, and used them to give his work structure. The uniqueness of his style stems in part from his reliance on sources that, quote-unquote, serious artists wouldn't even look at, let alone read or use. Tarantino is obsessed with cinema, specifically genre cinema and the various subgenres they fracture into. He has a particular love for exploitation film, low-budget B-movies that exploit an audience's desire for violence, sex, and other cheap thrills. Like mysticism, pulpy genre movies comprise a dense and obscure text, one that, quote-unquote, serious filmmakers and film critics long ignored and disparaged. Tarantino, delighted by lowbrow cinema from a young age, extracted the patterns he found there and used them to give his work structure. On their own, his films are sophisticated in the ways they manipulate and combine generic tropes without forgetting to honor their payoffs, to deliver the goods, as Tarantino likes to say. Together, they make a case for the worth of critically neglected filmmaking and for the larger significance of genre itself. The two artists' aims are different, of course. Yates wanted to answer humanity's deepest questions, to unravel the meaning of life and the pattern of history. You know, small stuff. Poetry was the means to these ends. For Tarantino, film is a means and an end. He uses cinema to say something about cinema, about what it can do. This is why his work is sometimes criticized as a callow triumph of technique over substance. But that view is as shallow as it claims Tarantino is, partly because there's a great deal of substance in his films, partly because genre is a rich subject matter, more than worthy of an artist's focus. What unites these two isn't the scope of their oeuvres, but their awareness of its value as a creative tool. After Tarantino released Reservoir Dogs in 1992, critic Gavin Smith predicted the movie would prove pivotal in the history of American independent film for legitimizing its relationship to Hollywood genre. Smith implies a conflict between genre and independent film, and in some ways there is. Hollywood uses genre to serve its commercial interests. Its predictable structures are perfect for mass market storytelling. This is why film genre is often associated with superficiality, cynicism, and the profit motive. Independent film, on the other hand, is associated with art cinema. Lower budgets means less pressure to appeal to a wide audience, means more freedom to engage difficult and controversial subjects. Independent films don't have to use genre's formulas. They don't have to end with a kiss, or with the villain captured, or with the last stupid teenager escaping from the haunted house. But these are simplistic categories. Hollywood genre films can be artistic, and independent films can be commercial. Footnote. In fact, a lot of indie studios are actually owned by the majors. Focus Features, owned by Comcast. Searchlight Pictures, owned by Disney. Sony Picture Classics, owned by Sony. End footnote. Independent film is also a source of genre film. Horror, for example, is a film genre that can be produced for cheap, yet few independent horror movies would be considered art cinema, despite the recent wave of art horror. Independent, studio, genre, and art are labels that can be mixed and matched in different ways. So when Smith says Reservoir Dogs legitimizes the relationship between independent film and Hollywood genre, is he right? Did it need legitimizing? By the early 90s, there had already been lots of independent genre work. Movies like Mean Streets, 1973, crime film. Annie Hall, 1977, romantic comedy. And Blood Simple, 1984, film noir. Many of these revisionist films helped to establish genre as a locus of high art, and they all came out before Reservoir Dogs. What makes Tarantino's genre obsession different? In Tarantino's aesthetics, writes I.L. Peretz, nothing is ever simply or really itself. Every single gesture seems always to be marked by its own cinematic nature, as belonging to a genre or being a quotation or the performance of a role. In other words, Tarantino forces us to see genre. In other genre movies, story may be bound by certain rules, but the on-screen content is presented as natural, not as something framed by the genre and its conventions. Even a film as genre-based as Spielberg's Raiders of the Lost Ark, an adventure movie that intentionally modernizes early 20th century serials like Buck Rogers and Zorro's Fighting Legion, attempts to blur the edges of the frame. It winks at its antecedents, but that's all. The movie does not want to call attention to its moviness. For Spielberg, that would defeat the point. It would break the suspension of disbelief. For Tarantino, the point is already defeated. According to him, suspension of disbelief isn't worth aiming for because it doesn't really exist. That's a theory that I don't think is actually a practice, he told Stephen Colbert in 2015. I always know I'm watching a movie. Whether or not he's right, Tarantino makes sure we always know his movies are movies when we're watching them. Reservoir Dogs isn't just a film about a heist, it's a heist film about a heist. And from the very beginning, that crime film subgenre is made visible to the viewer. After the long chat about Madonna and tipping etiquette that opens the movie, the dogs exit the diner in matching black suits, while Little Green Bag by George Baker Selection plays under credits. Here, the film quotes a classic of the heist subgenre, 1960's Ocean's 11, which ends with exactly the same imagery, suited robbers walking together, looking cool, under credits. Jean-Pierre Melville's 1966 heist film, Le Deuxième Souffle, features the image again, robbers clad in black suits, fedoras, and trench coats walking along a mountain road. The suits appear yet again in John Woo's A Better Tomorrow 2, a crime action classic of Hong Kong cinema. We've barely made it 8 minutes before a raft of quotes leads us back through the history of the heist movie, situating Reservoir Dogs firmly within its generic legacy. This is what Peretz means when he says every single gesture seems always to be marked by its own cinematic nature. Tarantino wants us to see the marks of genre in every frame, and we do, even if we don't and couldn't possibly share his exhaustive knowledge of cinema, even if we don't catch all the quotes. As media consumers, we're educated enough to pick up on the markers of specific genres, whether or not we can place their sources. You might not know, for example, that when Mr. White says to Mr. Blonde in that diner scene, "You shoot me in a dream, you better wake up and apologize," he's quoting James Cagney from the 1938 gangster film Angels with Dirty Faces. But you know it's the kind of wisecrack a gangster might make. Eventually, those markers make it into the cultural drinking water. In the decades since Reservoir Dogs came out, our familiarity with all kinds of media has grown exponentially, but it was already good enough in 92 for Tarantino to craft a movie out of it. For all the twists he puts on the heist film, several of the classic tropes remain intact. A group of thieves organize a jewel heist after crime lord Joe Cabot, played by Lawrence Tierney, famous for his mobster roles in the 1940s, tips them off to a shipment of polished stones moving through a diamond wholesaler in Los Angeles. As the savvy filmgoer might guess, the heist goes off the rails. The criminals turn on one another before the police arrive and finish them off. These are the ingredients you can find in 1,000 movie capers about which Reservoir Dogs is self-aware. Talk about a colorful group of thieves. The names of these thieves are actually colors. The ingredient Reservoir Dogs lacks is the one that's most fundamental to the genre, the heist itself. After the opening scene, the movie jumps forward to the post-heist. Through flashbacks, Tarantino fills in some of what happened before the crime, but we don't see a second of the robbery itself. All we get is the characters' stories as they scramble to figure out how it all went belly up. This omission is Reservoir Dogs' biggest spin on the genre. Another spin is Tarantino's characterizations of the dogs, namely the way they talk. As Tarantino says, gangsters don't just talk about gangster plot-related stuff and just polish their bullets. They talk about songs on the radio. They talk about the chicken dinner they had last night. This realism humanizes his genre characters and provides a comedic counterpoint to the film's convulsions of violence. Still another spin is the non-linear narrative technique Tarantino uses and became famous for. Reservoir Dogs rearranges plot points to prompt more engagement from its audience. Tarantino spins the heist film, but he doesn't revolutionize it and doesn't try to. He's not looking to transcend genre in the way many revisionist movies seek to do. He's not using genre as a tool to get somewhere else. Tarantino sees value in its formulas and tropes and payoffs. He may use our expectations against us, updating the genre for a savvy modern viewer, but he ultimately wants to reaffirm its power as a narrative form. He wants to deliver the goods. The art of the horror film, writes film theorist Carol Clover in Men, Women, and Chainsaws, which Tarantino cites as an influence, is to a very large extent the art of rendition or performance, and it's understood as such by the competent audience. A particular example may have original features, but its quality as a horror film lies in the way it delivers the cliché. You could swap horror for any genre, and the point would hold. With his wide knowledge, Tarantino performs genre better than any other filmmaker. He delivers the cliché with gusto. Look at Pulp Fiction. Staying with the crime film, Tarantino weaves together three of the genre's most cliché scenarios. 1. Two hitmen execute a hit. 2. Boxer who was supposed to throw a fight doesn't. 3. Underling takes out the boss's daughter. These are stock situations from the rag and bone shop of the genre, and we know how they go. The hit goes wrong, the boxer has to run, the underling defies the most important rule, look but don't touch. As in Reservoir Dogs, Tarantino spins the stories in exciting ways. He uses the nonlinear narrative technique to great effect. He uses our familiarity with the crime film against us to thrill and surprise. The result is a virtuosic performance of genre, an affirmation of its myths, created from a tapestry of its most archetypal narratives. Like Two Songs from a Play does to The Second Coming, Pulp Fiction deepens and expands Reservoir Dogs' perspective on genre. It begins to bring Tarantino's larger project into focus. Tarantino's third movie, Jackie Brown, concludes a trilogy of films in the crime genre and tightens that focus again. It's adapted from a novel by Elmore Leonard, another big influence on Tarantino. Elmore Leonard, in his books, would always throw all these kinds of monkey wrenches that just smack true of life, Tarantino said in 1992. Cops are chasing after a character. Character is running down a street. They commandeer a car, throw the person out, jump in the car. But it's a stick shift, and they don't drive stick. That's real life. It kind of fucks up the genre moment. That's what I'm always trying to do. Like Tarantino, Leonard fucks with genre lovingly, not to dismantle, but to re-energize it. Like Tarantino, Leonard honors the payoffs of genre fiction. He delivers the goods. So what are these goods? Joyce Carol Oates puts it best. However plot-ridden, fantastical, or absurd, whatever pseudo-characters, genre fiction is always resolved. She was writing about literature, but the idea applies to any kind of fiction. Earlier, I dismissed genre endings as facile, the lover's kiss, the villain bested, the last teenager alive, but they are not facile by definition. Tarantino aims to prove that. Jackie Brown ends in the most cliche of ways, with a romantic kiss before the hero drives into the sunset, having overcome the forces arrayed against her, a bag of cash in the trunk. Shallow as it reads, this ending is anything but. When Jackie Brown arrives at its resolution after 2 hours of gripping, character-driven storytelling, it offers a closure that is profoundly rewarding for the viewer. It satisfies in a way that is unique to genre fiction. Tarantino's engagement with genre becomes extreme in his fourth movie, Kill Bill, an epic revenge saga divided into two volumes and several chapters. Footnote: Kill Bill is technically two movies, Kill Bill Volume 1 and Kill Bill Volume 2, but Tarantino counts them as a single entry in his oeuvre. End footnote. Each chapter adopts its own genre, has its own arc and mini-resolution, as the bride kills her way to a final confrontation with the titular Big Bad. In its genre travelogue, Kill Bill visits the samurai epic, the kung fu revenge flick, the spaghetti western, the blaxploitation film, anime, and more. It's a symphony of genre, with references beyond count. If his prior films drew heavily from film history, Kill Bill seems to be assembled out of it, a true pastiche. This is what Stanford professor Gene Ma calls Tarantino's manic referentiality, his self-conscious forging of a directorial style from an intertextual network that extends downward into the trash bin of film history. What keeps the film from being derivative is its hybrid nature, Tarantino's peerless talent for mix and match. Who else could take all those fragments and fuse them into a coherent narrative? Who else would even try? With Kill Bill, Tarantino advances toward the mythic. The bride's quest for revenge plays like a classic saga, complete with trials, betrayals, and a wise mentor. She has the winds of destiny at her back. The finale feels inevitable, yet perils along the way remain thrilling. We know the movie will end how its title predicts. She will kill Bill. But that doesn't rob the story of its drama. More than other film genres, with the possible exception of horror, revenge narratives depend on the art of performance. Maybe this is why so many of the movies in the latter half of Tarantino's career feature or center on revenge. Among other things, Inglourious Basterds is the story of Shoshana Dreyfus's revenge on the Nazis who killed her family. Django Unchained tells the story of Django Freeman's revenge on the slaveholders in the antebellum South who enslaved and abused him and his wife. In The Hateful Eight, Major Marquis Warren exacts revenge on General Smithers for his executions of black prisoners at the Battle of Baton Rouge. In Death Proof, stuntman Mike's would-be victims deliver vengeance by running him off the road and beating him to death. Even the finale of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, when Cliff Booth and Rick Dalton kill Charles Manson's lackeys, can be seen as symbolic revenge for the real murder of Sharon Tate. In Tarantino's filmography, those who deserve revenge always get their wish before the credits roll. Sometimes they are destroyed in the process, like Shoshana or Major Warren. Sometimes they get a happier ending, like The Bride or Django. But both endings can be gratifying as long as vengeance is attained. Revenge is an intense form of closure, maybe the most intense form, so it plays to genre's strengths. It's more than just gratifying, it's retributive justice, a kind of healing. Drawing on its proximity to myth and fable, Tarantino tests genre's ability to provide closure not just for people's wounds, but historical wounds, like Nazism, American slavery, and the Manson murders. Discussing Django with NPR, Tarantino said he wanted to use the spaghetti western genre to give Django the folkloric tale he deserves. In this case, genre offered Tarantino a mythic frame to foreground strength and resilience in a story of retribution and a figure of empowerment. Of course, the finale of Django, in which the hero dynamites a slave plantation, like the finale of Inglourious Basterds, in which Shoshana kills the Nazi high command, can't deliver real closure. Those wounds are too deep. But we've always turned to stories for the resolutions we can't find in life. And we've turned to genre for the sudden joyous turn that J.R.R. Tolkien once described, happy endings that give a fleeting glimpse of joy, joy beyond the walls of the world, poignant as grief. In Tarantino's filmography, we see a conversation about what genre is and can do, about what these narrative formulas have carried through time from the earliest days of human storytelling. Just like Yeats's poems, Tarantino's films reinforce, deepen, and qualify all the other films in his oeuvre. He doesn't share Yeats's broad scope, but his movies exist in a common sphere of genre, with a similar style of manic referentiality, in which every single gesture seems always to be marked by its own cinematic nature, so new entries comment on those that came before. In their constant quotations, the nine films in Tarantino's current oeuvre tell a different story of cinema history than you might find in a university course or a list of the best films ever made. Tarantino's oeuvre creates its own canon, one that's strange and diverse and unafraid to dumpster dive in the trash bin of film history. It runs a twisting route through 30s gangster movies, blaxploitation cinema, Melville's proto-new wave noirs, spaghetti westerns, grindhouse fare, 60s screwball comedies, 80s Hong Kong actioners, Italian poliziotteschi, giallo horror, slasher movies, hangout movies, the Shaw Brothers studio, Douglas Sirk, Pam Grier, De Palma, Fukasaku, Peckinpah, and much more. This canon pays no mind to the highbrow-lowbrow divide. If anything, it favors the latter. It champions so much of what our cultural memory has forgotten, evidenced by the fact that you can't find a lot of these movies. Some are unrestored, others out of print. Others, the film stock having decayed, are gone forever. Tarantino's oeuvre advocates the value of neglected movies. He proves their contribution to film language, like an etymologist tracing the origin of common words to their unremembered roots. He reminds us that it's often in the trash bins of culture where exciting experimentation occurs. What we snobbishly consider bad taste today might, in time, be seen as fundamental to the medium. In this way, Tarantino's movies also illustrate just how much cinematic memory depends on the allocation of resources. What we don't preserve will eventually vanish. What we have preserved says as much about us as it does about film. what we recognize as significance. There are as many film histories as filmgoers. For most, it's a scattershot history drawn by our interests and what we happen to be exposed to. In a filmmaker's work, you can find a more focused history, guiding their choices sometimes consciously, sometimes not. After a career, you can connect the dots and sketch out the constellation of their influences. With Tarantino, as with Yates, it's always conscious. The choices he makes are considered before the fact, and their shape doesn't just tell you something about him, but about film itself, about genre, about narrative closure and the art of performance, about neglected films and filmmakers, about cinematic memory. Tarantino's oeuvre is as expressive as any of his movies, as any individual work of art. It is a work of art. Someone mind telling that to Peter Travers? Superman is Clark Kent. Superman did not become Superman. Superman was born Superman. When Superman wakes up in the morning, he's Superman. His alter ego is Clark Kent. His outfit with the big red S, that's the blanket he was wrapped in as a baby when the Kents found him. Those are his clothes. What Kent wears, the glasses, the business suit, that's the costume. That's the costume Superman wears to blend in with us. Clark Kent is how Superman views us. And what are the characteristics of Clark Kent? He's weak. He's unsure of himself. He's a coward. Clark Kent is Superman's critique on the whole human race. So says Bill, the eponymous villain of Quentin Tarantino's revenge epic Kill Bill at the film's climax. As the previous essay makes clear, I'm a big fan of Tarantino's work, but I'm a bigger fan of Superman, a super fan, if you will. And as a super fan, I'm forced to explain why I think this is the exact wrong take on the Man of Steel. Of the famous Clark Kent-Superman dichotomy, Bill suggests that Superman is the real personality and Clark Kent is the disguise. I think the opposite is true. I believe Clark is the core of the character, not the superhero. And I think the best Superman stories emphasize that, while those that neglect the Kent side tend to be flat and forgettable. Clark Kent is not the creation. Superman is. Clark Kent is not Superman. Superman is Clark Kent. Maybe it seems trivial to devote an essay in this book to superhero identity, but anyone who's known me since junior high would be more likely to wonder why only one chapter of this book focuses on the last son of Krypton. Superman was my first obsession, before Emerson or The Lord of the Rings or cyberpunk or movies. Superman switched on the obsessive part of my mind, the part that has to know everything there possibly is to know about a subject, the part that stays up late to read one more chapter or comic, the part that robs focus from schoolwork or work to daydream about fan fiction while drawing 8 million Superman S's on every page of my chemistry notebook. All my other obsessions, a few of which are covered in this book, flow from Superman. In an earlier chapter, I describe how Emerson's essays punctured my apathy and inspired a curiosity about reading and writing that effectively rebooted my life. I was apathetic in secondary school, always doing the least work necessary to satisfy my parents and teachers. But outside of school, I was enthralled by the mythological multiverse of DC Comics. At the time, those two things, academics and comics, seemed like separate worlds. One was boring and mandatory, the other fun and something I chose. But fascination is contagious. The experience is more important than its object, especially for a young mind. It's a superpower all its own, a heat vision that ignites whatever it sees, even those things that used to look boring. Superman is not a highbrow subject, but it's a dense one. There's a lot there for a kid in his early teens to explore. We're talking about one of the most recognizable fictional characters of the last century, a global icon. It's hard to imagine anyone who would be unfamiliar with the red and yellow S symbol. Since his debut in Action Comics No. 1 on April 18, 1938, which inaugurated the superhero genre, Superman has featured in thousands of original stories, mostly in the many ongoing comics that bear his name, but also in every other possible medium: television, film, radio, theater, books, video games. All these interpretations add up to an elaborate mythos that reflects the visions of hundreds of artists, beginning with Superman's creators, Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster. Even now, 80-some-odd years later, that mythos continues to grow, maybe at a faster rate than ever before. For a young me, Superman was a never-ending wellspring of new adventures to devour. For all the thousands of chapters in the Superman story, the basics of the mythos are simple and familiar. In his acclaimed series All-Star Superman, Grant Morrison captured the backstory in 4 panels and 8 words. Doomed planet, desperate scientists, last hope, kindly couple. The doomed planet is Krypton, Superman's homeworld. The desperate scientists are his birth parents, Jor-El and Lara, who tried to warn Krypton's leaders that the planet was on the verge of exploding. The last hope is Kal-El, Superman's Kryptonian name, who was launched by his parents into space before the tragedy, the only survivor of his species. And the kindly couple is Jonathan and Martha Kent, farmers from Kansas who discovered a spaceship with a baby inside and decided to raise him as their son, Clark. In slightly more words, the same origin is told on the first page of Action Comics No. 1, minus the Kents, who didn't appear until a year later, and these points remained more or less fixed throughout the decades. You know what comes next. Clark grows up in Smallville and finds that he has special physical abilities, including but not limited to invulnerability, super strength, super speed, super hearing, super breath, X-ray vision, heat vision, and flight. Influenced by the virtuous moral code of his adoptive parents, Clark decides to use his powers to help others. He moves to Metropolis and dons 2 costumes, the red and blue tights of Superman and that of a mild-mannered reporter who works at the city's premier newspaper, the Daily Planet. At the planet, he meets Lois Lane, also a reporter and a damn good one, who falls in love with Superman but won't give Kent the time of day. At some point, Superman encounters Lex Luthor, his arch-nemesis, a genius threatened by the Man of Steel's power. Throw in